Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. The Atlantic Council last week issued a new report, The China Plan, a transatlantic blueprint for strategic cooperation, with recommendations to bring together the Atlantic Alliance to present a more united economic, diplomatic, and security front against an increasingly assertive China. Joining us to discuss the report are four of the august team that put it together, led by Chris Scaluba, the director at the director of the beating heart of the Atlantic Council, the Transatlantic Security Program at the Scowcroft Center, Dr. Sarah Kirchberger, a non-resident senior fellow at the Council, who is also the head of Asia-Pacific Strategy and Security at the Institute for Security Policy at Kiel University, and a vice president of the German Maritime Institute, Frank Kramer, who served as the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy, who is now a distinguished fellow and a board director at the Council, and Dr. Hans Benendijk, a veteran of the National Security Council, the State Department, as well as the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who was also a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council. Absolute pleasure having you all on, especially since we're so vastly geographically distributed. Yet one of the things that we've all managed to perfect over the course of this awful pandemic. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our coverage of technology. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our coverage of air and missile defense. Chris, tremendous report. It is very much a blueprint for action for the United States, NATO, and its EU allies together, as well as cross-connecting with our friends in Asia. As we've discussed, this administration is taking a tougher line on China and trying to do so in a more coordinated way. That, in turn, is irritating Beijing, which is lashing out at our allies. As we saw, the EU-China trade deal appears to be in jeopardy in the wake of the EU siding with the United States on sanctions, as I mentioned at the top of the show. What are the key elements of this blueprint from your standpoint?
Yeah, thanks, Vago, again, for having us. Really excited to be on and talk about the piece. And I have to tell you, it was a labor. We've been working on this for well over a year in a very dedicated fashion. You know, in terms of maybe the kind of overall key to it, the overall impact, when we sat down to do it, we really stepped back and thought, you know, there's so many people writing in this space, working in this space on China in Europe, China in the United States. What can we do to really advance that conversation? And what became clear pretty early was that no one was kind of looking at the whole enchilada, if you will, looking across human rights, coercive diplomacy, technology competition, economics and trade, intelligence, security. And so as I was talking with Sarah and with Hans and with Frank, based on his previous work about, you know, what value we could add, it became clear that if we could bite off the whole piece of it in a credible way, then we would do a service. And so that's what we set out to do. And I'm really happy that we were able to do it. I think the second thing I note is the frame for this. We really wanted to make it practical. I think one of the real values of it is the fact that there are so many things that the Biden administration, policymakers in Europe can take and do right away. It really was done through the lens of kind of practical recommendations. But to get there, we really needed to understand where the convergences, divergences, and asymmetries in thought, philosophy, policy between the United States and Europe existed. And there's a couple of studies we had relied upon who had done a little bit of this, but some time ago. And so I think that ended up being a really valuable way to kind of view the report, which is if we can figure out where we agree, there's some low-hanging fruit in terms of a collective strategy. If we could figure out where we don't always agree or don't agree at all, we can purpose our recommendations such that we can begin to mitigate those issues or work towards a common understanding. And so I think there's real value in the report there. Lastly, I'd say just importantly is that we really try to find balance in a number of ways. We really wanted folks on both sides of the Atlantic working this. And so we had Sarah and Didi Totlow and Clem Starling, who are Europeans, and the rest of us Americans. We had people like Hans and Sarah, who are renowned PhDs and who understand academic research, but then policymakers like Frank and Hans and myself, who kind of understand the practical aspects of this. Well, we needed sinologists like Sarah and Didi, as well as people that really know NATO and the transatlantic relationship kind of first off. And we really wanted it to be intergenerational. So there's people on the study team who have, you know, at all points of their careers, including really just young, brilliant minds like Connor McPartland and Clementine Starling, who were so critical to the success of the report. And lastly, and maybe most importantly, is this wasn't something where we divvied off assignments and went off into our corners and then came back a year later and put it together. We met every week on this as a study team and as a working group to work through the tough issues, to get the framing right, to get the organization right. And so overall, I think we have a report that has a very kind of academic depth of analysis, but that is very practical in terms of taking that analysis and turning it into actions for policymakers. And the overall kind of, I think, takeaway is that, you know, Europe and the United States really agree. We largely converge on human rights and coercive diplomacies. These things are at the heart of our democratic ideals. It's a much more mixed record on trade and technology, where we see some things similarly and other things very differently. And then, as Hans will talk about, on the security side, there's really asymmetric interests. The United States has responsibilities in the Asia Pacific that Europe doesn't have. We have power projection and other capabilities to deal with a rising Chinese military that Europe doesn't have. And so there's a lot of work to do on that front.
Frank, let me bring you into this, right? Because you are a policy practitioner. I think everybody's got bona fides on that front on this team, which is what makes this so interesting. But one of the key elements of it is a Transatlantic Coordination Council on China that's been adapted from your past work. You know, for anybody who doesn't understand this, right, you're one of the finest people to figure out mechanisms to actually get stuff done. Why is this council needed? And how would it work?
Thanks, Vago. And again, thanks for having us here. The key point, I think, that all of us who work in government understand, and especially transatlantically, is there are a lot of moving parts and a lot of important players, a lot of competencies, a lot of different authorities. And there's so many subjects that are involved when China comes up. That what I was thinking about was, how do we bring this together in an effective way? We suggested this concept of a transatlantic coordinating council because the scope of the issues are both large and broad. They relate to one another. Human rights, for example, relates to economics, as we've seen with respect to the sanctions that have recently been put in place with respect to cotton from Xinjiang province. There are multiple authorities, particularly in Europe. Nations have some authorities. The European Union has others. There are actually different institutions. The UK, for example, is no longer part of the EU, but you certainly need to include the UK in any China transatlantic policy. Same with Canada, for example, or even smaller countries like Iceland. We want also to make sure that the issues that are most appropriately in the competency of NATO are also thought about appropriately. And so the idea was to say, all right, let's create a policy council where we can have each of these relevant competencies, if you will, represented, and each of the issues represented. We called it the Transatlantic Coordinating Council for China. It would be really not a treaty, but a voluntary organization. And there are multiple voluntary organizations that have existed before that work very well. One is the so-called Financial Stability Board, which, as the name suggests, brings together nations to work on financial policies. Another in the security area was called the Proliferation Security Initiative, focusing on nuclear proliferation. So we thought that this is certainly a doable approach. And the council itself would meet at whatever level the senior authorities, heads of state, decided. You could have some summits, but you would also want to have some subgroups that might work on particular issues, like the issues we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. Could be an issue relating to the cyber field, 5G. It could be an economic issue. Could be a security issue. And you would have regular meetings. And then as recommendations are brought forward, they could be presented at the senior level, at a state level, if appropriate, or Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense level. You would have the Treasury and other economic groups involved. And then the relevant institutions that would be part of it, that is to say both the nations, the European Union, and NATO, would take those recommendations and then implement them using their own capacities and capabilities. So the broad idea is lots of things going on with respect to China, lots of entities that have to relate to one another, lots of authorities, and overlapping both institutions and problems. And that's how we got to the concept of let's put it all together in the context of a transatlantic coordinating council.
Sarah, you are one of Europe's leading China experts. One of the things that we have found is China certainly uses economic, uses trade as a weapon. That was one of the factors that compelled Germany, for example, to seek the EU trade deal, even though the Biden administration had asked, hey, look, hold off, Europe, let's get a concerted response to this. Every nation's economic interests were propelling it. In Germany, for example, on automobiles as well as machine tools, China is a very, very important market. How do you structure a collective transatlantic approach when each nation has their own economic interests? And for many of these nations now, China is their leading trading partner, not the United States. And China has demonstrated that it is willing to exact considerable pain over prolonged periods of time that it's willing to sustain, but some of our European partners are not. What's the right way to engineer this? Because at the end of the day, enforcing any form of discipline on the Chinese, the weapon of choice for Beijing will be trade.
Yeah, I completely agree that this is a difficult situation, but I would add that we have let this happen. We have let it come so far without realizing that there's literally no type of dependency that China will not exploit. And so the question that we need to ask ourselves is how dependent do we want to be on China? Not right now only, but in the future as well. And I think there's a lot of work to do in terms of arriving at something like an accurate situational awareness of the nature of all these dependencies and how real they really are. And just to mention one thing, since you brought up Germany's economic dependency on China, it's certainly true that China is the largest trading partner if you look at goods. But if you include services, for instance, then it's still the United States. So it's always a matter of looking at the data in different ways. And another thing, one very renowned institute for economic research in Germany, the IFO Institute, came up last year with a number of just 3% of gross value added in Germany that is actually dependent on exports to China. So that is not a lot, right? 3%, 97% would be unaffected. So the question is, from my point of view, how far should the interests of maybe one large company like Volkswagen be allowed to dominate the national interest? This is really a question for policymakers. And across Europe, you find all these different types of dependencies that have developed, be it in terms of infrastructure investments or such trade dependencies. And what I think, looking at all of it, is that in many ways, the individual dependencies are sometimes a little bit overstated in the way that they define the national interest. That is one thing. Then the other thing is this something that we should accept as an immutable fact? Because if we know that China has basically conducted an analysis of how to apply pain in the most efficient way and how to hurt trading partners in the most efficient way, this doesn't really speak to, harmless harmless and friendly intentions. It looks more like weaponizing trade relationships. And then there's another aspect. There's a mutuality in terms of dependency. China also is dependent on its export markets and its import markets. It cuts both ways. So what we seem to not have been done in the past, we seemingly haven't looked into our own levers of exerting influence on China really in a systematic way. And we seem to be very reluctant to even think how we could utilize those dependencies of China to defend ourselves against, for instance, weaponizing trade to achieve political aims. And if you look at what we've been seeing in these past few months alone, like using trade as a weapon against Australia or against Taiwan, one can also conclude that all these countries have now been forced to come up with coping mechanisms, finding different markets for the products that the Chinese now reject. And so what we should ask ourselves, in my view, is how can we systematically work on reducing one-sided dependencies that could then be weaponized by China, or we could even say will be weaponized by China if necessary. So this is really what I see happening in Europe, a reckoning. And maybe I should also add, Europe is not in any way a uniform actor in this way. So the large countries like France and Germany and Britain tend to sometimes forget that many of the smaller countries that make up Europe have different historical experiences and different preferences regarding China than the big ones. And in particular, the Baltic countries or the, in general, the post-communist countries of Europe, they are often much more sensitive to the risks of becoming too dependent on China. And the big countries tend to forget that these countries value freedom and human rights as something that they fought for very hard and waited for a very long time. And so it's definitely wrong to think that, for instance, Germany's position should or can dominate Europe. And even within countries such as Germany that have long been seen as very China-friendly, you can now notice a shift, I think. So if you look at the German position, what our government is doing with relations to China is being challenged from within. Even from within the ruling party, there's a lot of criticism in terms of not being clear enough, not being firm enough, being pushed around by China. And so I basically expect in most European countries, the China skeptics to become more influential, because after all, China has sort of dropped the mask within the past couple of months and really right. shown how far it is willing to go in terms of exerting economic pain.
Hans, let me bring you into the conversation from a security perspective, because you are were instrumental in studying that. There's a tendency that Europeans have historically had of sort of what happens in Asia stays in Asia, as opposed to thinking that in the event of a crisis between China and the Philippines and or China and Japan, the United States gets pulled into it, and then European nations will find themselves in Asia through Article 5, for example, just like many Europeans would never have assumed they would have been in Afghanistan, and yet that's what happened. What's the strategic approach, right? The collective security approach nations need in dealing with China. I know you've written about the importance of freedom of navigation operations. Britain, France, Germany have joined the United States in doing those to sort of underscore the importance of open and transitable international waters. But at the end of the day, you also need a broader and a deeper strategy. What does that need to look like from your standpoint?
So NATO has indeed begun to focus on the challenges from China. Secretary General of the Alliance, Stoltenberg, has said China has come to Europe, and the new strategic concept that the Alliance is going to be writing over the next year or so is going to focus, among other things, on China. But the concern is that that will be a narrow focus, that the Alliance is indeed looking at the challenge that China poses to Europe in Europe. There are challenges. Chinese investments in ports and infrastructure, supply chain dependencies in the defense area, rare earth mineral dependencies, and political influence that China is exerting in Europe. But those are issues that NATO is beginning to deal with. But the real set of issues, the security issues that face Europe from China, are much more global in nature. So the alliance needs to broaden its focus. And that includes a shift of security attention to Asia and to China in the United States. That certainly will be a peacetime phenomenon coming up. And then, God forbid, if there is ever a conflict in Asia between the United States and China, the consequences for Europe would be very dramatic. Economically, the consequences would be severe, but as you point out, there is the Article 5 trigger that actually could involve Europe. So what to do about all of this? It seems to me there are four things that the alliance needs to do beyond what it's already planning to do, which is to focus more narrowly on Europe. The first is it needs to organize itself to better deal with these Asian issues. We have the United States now is involved in a quad with India, Australia, Japan. The NATO alliance needs to figure out how to plug into that. It needs to establish sort of outposts in Asia with centers of excellence, with liaison offices, with increased, as you point out, with increased exercises and FON operations, freedom of navigation operations. But so it's got to organize itself better to deal with the challenge. Secondly, should the United States have to shift forces to Asia, Europe becomes more vulnerable to Russian intimidation or worse. So there is a new burden-sharing argument. This is no longer just about the United States saying Europe's got to do more so that we in the United States don't have to carry all the burden. Now, Europe needs to think about what might happen should American forces be pulled to Asia and then conflict break out in Europe. So there is a new burden sharing argument, which is going to require adjustments in European military spending. Third, Europe needs to figure out how to help the United States deter China in Asia. These exercises are part of it. But it has to also be clear that there are some European red lines with regard to Taiwan, with regard to the Southeast China Seas. And then the fourth point is Chinese behavior in the global commons. Here it's in the seas, in space, in cyber, and in the Arctic. For example, Europe has significant security interests in these areas that are beyond just Europe. And so Europe has to figure out how to help the United States maintain freedom of operations in these various areas. And that's going to require a rethink in Europe with regard to its responsibility. So my main point here is Europe is focusing on China and on the Chinese challenge, the Chinese security challenge, but it's focusing too narrowly and it has to take a broader look.
I hope that people over in Europe do heed that, right? Because I think at the end of the day, the question is how everybody avoids conflict and the costs that go with it. And so there will have to be burdens borne to try to avoid potential, you know, something very expensive and devastating at the end of the day. Frank, we're going to go into a little bit of a lightning round because we've got many thoughtful participants and not as much time as I'd like for this. Is China containable from a technological standpoint at this point, Frank? I know you've looked at this issue, right? I mean, but there's a concern that unlike the Soviet Union, Chinese engineers, the best and brightest of China, has been schooled in the United States and Europe, worked at leading edge companies, led divisions back home in China of these leading edge companies, and now work for the Chinese state or state concerns. So there is this real sense that China is a technological power in its own right, but not necessarily in sort of the Rube Goldberg way that the Soviets had to do it. How containable is China at this point technologically?
Well, I think that the Chinese are, in general, so to speak, are very capable. I don't think that they are, so to speak, pound for pound equivalent to the United States and Europe together. But that doesn't mean that they don't have good capacity and in certain areas doing very well, for example, with respect to space as one good example, or 5G technology is another. So I think what we need to do are two things. One, we need to make sure that we're supporting our own innovation, both with the resources from the government and making sure that there's a significant transatlantic set of relationships and significant public-private set of relationships. We also need to not overly help the Chinese. That means we want to have some limitations on the kinds of things that, so to speak, are exported to China. We want to make sure that we're not sending them capabilities, whether it's semiconductor chips or the like, that they're using in their civil military fusion, for example. We want to, on our own side, ensure that we're resilient and that we don't create vulnerabilities that they can exploit. I could go on for a long time, but you said it was a lightning round, so let me stop there.
Thanks. Thanks very much, Frank. Sarah, Hans, do you guys want to add anything to that, right? Because at the end of the day, it's self-interest that's driving this, right? I mean, at the end of the day, that's been the challenge. Folks have wanted to access the Chinese market and made a whole bunch of devil's bargains in the process. Folks made money. There were cheaper products, right? Quality of life improved for a lot of people, but now we're realizing that we have certain vulnerabilities. Anything you two would like to add to the discussion, Sarah?
Yes, I would like to add that one major recommendation that we also make in that report is this shared intelligence picture that is really needed. And I think this is something that adds very nicely to what was already said, because China has really been very, very good at showing a different face to different countries and different players, and has also been really good at elite capture, trying to get influencers, you could say, in different countries that make China's case. And the result of this is that many players in the game do not have the full picture of the whole strategic context in which they operate. For instance, an individual company that produces one type of product that has maybe civilian and military applications does not necessarily understand that its product may be the one key piece missing from some Chinese weapons project. And they may not realize that they can become a target of particular attacks or particular approaches by Chinese agents. And so this is something that I think we could really try to remedy. We could try to plug those holes just by getting all the stakeholders to work together. We need to reach out to industry, different sectors, different transsectoral and transnational players that all deal with China, and try to educate everyone, get everyone on the same picture. And especially in terms of the military challenges that China is posing, I can tell you that in Europe, this has been a very rude awakening within only the past year or so, that this is really something that could touch upon Europe's interests. This knowledge has just been absent for the most part within Europe, outside of military circles. So this is really an important part of the whole piece that was missing. And there's other such pieces. So this is really, I think, where our approach must start, trying to get to be on the same page regarding the China challenge.
Hans, let me ask you a broader security dimension and then move down the line and get Chris's take on this in the sort of 5 or so minutes that we have left on the in the conversation. There has been a tendency of folks, whether in Washington or Europe, to sort of separate these channels, right? There's a China problem, there's a Russia problem. And increasingly, we're finding that Russia and China have common cause. They're making common cause with Iran, right? Both have struck trade deals there. There was strategic messaging in the wake of the meeting, obviously, with U.S. leaders that was a little bit on the tough side. The breakdown of, for example, the Europe-China trade deal. And now we find, right, that it's not just China, Russia, and Iran, but also North Korea, right? Because from Beijing's standpoint, that's a great disruptor. It consumes enormous amounts of bandwidth for Japanese, Korean, and U.S. officials. What is a collective approach that Western nations and democracies need to take in this sort of growing confederation of authoritarian states, that even some in Europe worry that a Viktor Orban, for example, may have more in common with this bloc than necessarily even in Europe? What's a collective approach to be taking with this, and want to get everybody's take on this really quickly? Go ahead, Hans.
Well, Valgo, you're right. What we have seen is closing of relationships between first Russia and China, most important, both authoritarian and becoming more authoritarian. But they are now reaching out to places like North Korea and Iran, in part in response to tougher positions being taken by the West. And we are therefore moving into more of a bilateral world. And there are fairly dramatic consequences for that. There are political, ideological consequences. We now are really in a world where we have democracies on the one hand, being challenged by authoritarian governments who basically are saying authoritarian leadership can be more effective. So we are in an ideological fight again for the first time since the Cold War. There are obviously military consequences to this as well. Chinese-Russian defense cooperation has profound effects for Europe and for the United States and for our Asian allies. So how do we manage that? You know, we almost need a dual-track approach. A truly bipolar world with confrontation is not necessarily a healthy world to live in. We have to be able to manage the ideological element of this and the military element of this, but it really means that our alliances are more important today than almost at any time since the end of the Cold War. We have to double down on alliances, and that's exactly what the Biden administration is doing. But we also need to seek ways where we can cooperate, recognizing that that's not always easy to do. But there are areas like arms control, like global warming, like dealing with pandemics. We have to recognize that cooperation requires both parties to cooperate. We have to look for those opportunities and follow sort of a dual track approach, which got us successfully through the Cold War.
Sarah, let me bring you into this, right? Because there's this, you know, astonishing bifurcation, right? For example, I know Nord Stream 2 is very controversial. On the one hand, right, Europe is trying to do trade. On the other hand, Russia is amassing tanks on the Ukrainian border again, right? During the Cold War, Italy was a key NATO ally. At the same time, its leading company, Fiat, was striking a major deal to build cars in the Soviet Union under license through Lada and the Vaz line. How does there need to be a more sort of collective security approach that doesn't look at these, you know, as Moscow and Beijing as separate, but Moscow and Beijing actually being in alignment at the end of the day, because they're both authoritarians and they want to live outside the rules?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I totally agree that it needs to be looked at in this way, simply for the reason that both countries actually have a number of synergies to exploit in terms of military cooperation that could become very tough for us to counter. So let me just mention the nightmare scenario that could happen. So what if Eastern Ukraine becomes a hot war and the Chinese decide this is the right moment to start trouble regarding Taiwan or seize some islands from the Philippines or invade the Senkakus or whatnot in a hybrid fashion, of course. So what then? What if we have to deal with two such scenarios at the exact same time? So it's pretty safe to say right now in Europe, nobody is prepared for that sort of scenario. The United States would probably be scrambling to solve the problem in the Western Pacific, and this might be an opening for Russia. And unfortunately in Europe, it is really tough because we have some stakeholders that still firmly believe that old approaches like the so-called Ostpolitik, the Eastern policy that West Germany had in the 1970s towards the Soviet Union, are now the right thing in this context that we currently have, regardless of the fact that the situation is much different. And so this is really, really a risky situation right now that authoritarian countries can exploit to probe how far the other side is willing to react and how far the other side is willing to go. I'm not totally optimistic that the lesson has been driven home yet. We are seeing this, these troop movements in Eastern Ukraine. We see the signs, we see the encircling of Taiwan, the Anaconda strategy that is employed against Taiwan. And yet I fear that a lot of people in Europe are still oblivious as to what that could actually mean in terms of a military crisis.
The plan is nothing, but planning is everything. And you do need to confront these kind of scenarios. I remember having conversations almost now, at least 15 years ago, with French officials who were already looking at this dynamic and saying, you know, the Chinese are going to be a really, really big problem. And maybe it doesn't make sense to be selling them these kind of dual use technologies that improve military capabilities. We don't have a lot of time left. Frank, why don't you give us your sense on this, and then Chris, bring us home. Go ahead, Frank.
I think one of the things we can do is to, if you will, change the structural situation. Sarah mentioned this earlier. We can reduce China's dominance in a variety of supply chains by encouraging that China not be the only place where key elements are either sold or are exported from. So Japan, for example, has a significant effort to have some of their companies move partially out of China. And I think all of us should think hard about creating what I have sometimes called a China plus one approach, especially for key critical infrastructures, key products, so that there's not this ability for China to squeeze, to use Sarah's metaphor, to have an anaconda approach. And the second thing I think we can do is to make sure that the transatlantic nations are working very closely with the nations of the Indo-Pacific. That probably would not be in a collective fashion and probably be multi-vector. It might be sector by sector. But we need to think hard about how to engage so that we all have the support of one another. For example, if China picks on a particular country, cut off exports to or imports from a country like Australia, there is a way to have an alternative for that country. And we shouldn't just make it that country's problem. It should be a problem that we all deal with.
And Chris, you've been very, very patient. Give us some closing thoughts on the discussion, and maybe broader ways that we need to think about the challenge, not just in a China channel, a Russia channel, an Iran channel, but actually kind of a broader, more strategic approach to the whole enchilada, no pun intended.
Or the
schnitzel or something like that. I mean, croqueta, because I know we've got both Dutch and German representation here as well.
That's right. Well, first of all, Vago, thanks for the conversation. It was really a pleasure to do this. And it's very, very easy to be patient when you get to hear such thoughtful and brilliant people. And this is what this project was. We were together every week talking through things. And just like at every one of those weeks, I absolutely learned listening to my colleagues today. I think you pick up on a really interesting point in terms of thinking about these challenges collectively, not just China in a stovepipe or Russia in a stovepipe or Iran stovepipe. And this gets to something I've been thinking about, which I haven't shared with my colleagues yet, but I'm trying to write something on this right now, is that my experience, as you know, is from the Pentagon. The Pentagon is driven and structured to think through problems regionally, with kind of the functional part of the of the enterprise, trying to kind of bring everything together. I do wonder if it's not time to kind of rethink that approach. Maybe it would be better to have an assistant secretary thinking about adversaries overall and an assistant secretary thinking about allies, so we understand both the threats and the capabilities on both sides of the ledger. But there's work to do. There's work to do there. I do think one of the real benefits and services of this report is to be able to think about this China problem in a cross-disciplinary way. Right. I really hope that people can, you know, who are human rights experts can read the security section and understand things they didn't realize before. People that are economists can read the technology section and learn something. I think that in many ways is the benefit of the report, to recognize exactly how thoughtful and conscious and clever, frankly, China has been in its strategy to divide us as allies. And as Sarah said, we really need that common intelligence picture to kind of inform a broader public discussion so everyone recognizes exactly what's happening. Lastly, and maybe to wrap it up and just to pull on a thread that Frank started, this really does matter, not just transatlantically, but in terms of how we link up with all democracies globally, especially our allies and our partners in the Indo-Pacific. To channel Secretary Blinken, I think what he said last week or the week before is that, you know, when you add the United States and Canada to Europe and to the Asian democracies, we are still 60-65% of the global economy. So to your point, China is very good at certain things. They are having success in a way that the Soviet Union maybe didn't on the technological front. But when we work together, when we work collectively, we're still the best bet in town. And so this report is really meant as a call to let's work together more urgently, more collectively across all disciplines. And if we do that, I feel pretty good about our chances.
Chris, Frank, Sarah, Hans, thanks so very much for joining us. A little bit of a deeper dive than we originally intended, but we think the subject is well worth it. I commend to the audience, the report is comprehensive. There is a lot of detail in it. It's 108 pages, but it is also full of a lot of practical, right? It's not aspirational stuff. You guys do recommend a whole series of practical steps. Everybody, thanks so very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.